All right. Hello, everyone. All right. We're going to get started now. Welcome to the CS50 review for Quiz Zero. My name is Matthew Chartier. I'll be starting the review session for tonight. Okay. So we're going to start out talking about just some basic concepts, which kind of serve as building blocks for other things that you'll be using in computer science and also particularly working with C, and which will be useful for the quiz this week. So let's on. We're not in presentation.
Top left.
Top left. From beginning?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to start out just by talking about binary numbers. Now, binary numbers are obviously very important in computer science because at the most basic level, everything in your computer is represented by bits and bytes. And a bit can only alternate between two settings. Essentially, a bit is either switched on or it's switched off. So you can imagine if you want to represent something larger than just this bit value using multiple bit values, that you need a system which can kind of take this one or a zero, essentially, and build on it to give you something greater than just these two values. So the way we do that is by representing larger numbers using a binary system, which is essentially just a base 2 representation of numbers. As I said, a bit can essentially be switched on or off, so a bit can be thought of as representing either the number 1 or the number 0. And just as in a decimal system, we have 10 different digits. Each digit has 10 possible values, 0 through 9, which gives us a base 10 system. This essentially gives us the tools to create a base 2 representation of numbers. So if we take a look at the components of a binary number, suppose we imagine we have 8 digits that are either 1 or 0. The rightmost digit represents essentially a multiple of a power of 2, starting with 2 to the 0, and then incrementing by 1 as we move towards the left. So you see with 8 bits in 1 byte, using binary, we can represent a number that is as large as 2 to the 7th plus 2 to the 6th plus 2 to the 5th, all the way down to plus 2 to the 0th, which is essentially 2 to the 8th minus 1. Since we're also representing the number 0, using 8 bits, we can represent 2 to the 8th numbers, which means since we're including 0, we can represent anything from 0 to 2 to the 8th minus 1. So suppose we had some binary number with 8 digits, and you have 8 ones and zeros, essentially. So maybe it would look something like this. 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1. So using a system like this, looking at each digit as representing a power of 2, you can figure out in decimal what this number is by looking simply at the binary. So you get 2 to the 7th, which is 128, plus 2 to the 6th, you get 64, so you get the total of 192. We move over here, we have 2 to the 1, 194, and 2 to the 0, we end up with 195. So it's very simple if you think in terms of powers of 2 to convert from binary into decimal, and vice versa. If we were to take the number, say, 97, and consider how we would convert that into binary, if we think of having 8 digits, because we know we can represent this number in 1 byte, it's small enough, it's less than or equal to 255, if we're considering this an unsigned int, meaning it's only positive values. Then if we think of the largest power of 2, which we can fit into 97, which is 64, 2 to the 6th, we go to our 2 to the 6th place. So I go 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I know I have a 2 to the 6th in here. I said 97. So 2 to the 5th would be a 32, and we can fit that in there as well. So now we have up to 96. We have 1 left. So the only power of 2 we can fit there is 2 to the 0. So we'd go here and fill in 1 there, and everything else, of course, is 0. So this is just a simple way of showing how we can represent any number using a series of binary digits. Okay. And clearly you can see here, if you wanted to count in binary, you would just increment the rightmost digit, and in the case that it's already a 1, then you would simply carry over, and clearly you can go up to 255, which is when all the digits are 1, assuming we're looking at an unsigned integer. If we're looking at a signed integer, then the leftmost bit, well, the way it's represented, We needn't go into detail, but you'd be able to access 256 different numbers from negative 128 to positive 127. So the upward bound of how high you can go is lower, but you're able to access negative integers as well. Okay, so now talking about a hexadecimal numbering system, which is essentially base 16. So where we look at each digit in binary as being 2 to a certain power, we could look at each digit in a large hexadecimal number as being 16 to a certain power, where the power is dependent on how close to the right of the number this is, just as we do in decimal with powers of 10. And the reason hexadecimal is useful is because it makes it very simple to represent the value of bytes. So if you think about a byte, it's 8 bits, and a hexadecimal number is able to represent one digit is able to represent 16 different combinations, essentially. And with 4 bits, you can represent 16 combinations, sorry. So you can see how you could represent a single byte or with only two hexadecimal digits. And this results in hexadecimal numbers being very useful for displaying memory addresses. So, like I said, there's 16 possible values for each digit in a hexadecimal number. 0 through 9 are the same as in a decimal system, but whereas in decimal system you would carry over into your second column for the numbers 10 through 15, we just use the alphabetical characters A through F to represent 10 through 15. A is 10, B is 11, and so on. And like I said, as we see here, you can represent the largest hexadecimal digit, which is F, which represents 15, in only 4 bits. So what that essentially means is that using a full byte, which is 2 nibbles, essentially, a nibble being 4 bits, you can represent all possible values in this single byte using only 2 hexadecimal digits. And in lecture, we use the example of if you look in Photoshop and you're trying to select a value for a color, since all colors are just combinations of red, green, and blue, you can represent kind of the degree of red, green, or blue that go into the color using 2 hexadecimal digits. So you'd essentially have 256 different degrees to which you can have that color there. And if you placed 2 hexadecimal digits on the left of your number, which represented the degree of red, 2 in the center, which represented the degree of green, and 2 on the right, which represented the degree of blue. It's very simple to kind of represent a color using hexadecimal and have this convenient set length, which the number occupies in memory, and be able to intuitively look at those values and understand what they mean. So next we're going to talk a little bit about ASCII, which was very useful on problem set 2, in which you worked with the Caesar and Vigenère ciphers. If you recall, you had to manipulate the characters in order to rotate them in the alphabet by adding them and subtracting the certain ASCII values, which helped you to rotate to the beginning of the alphabet. Essentially, ASCII allows I say values 0 through 127. These are the standard ASCII values, which we would generally use. You can use the extended ASCII table to map characters from 0 to 255, but normally we're going to be mostly concerned with these, which can be stored from 0 to 127. And one byte can store any of these 128 different characters, and also, of course, since a byte is capable of holding 256 different values, then it could also hold all the characters which are found in this extended ASCII table. But we're mostly just going to concern ourselves with what we would see here. If any of you have been to ASCIITable.com, which you probably should have been for problem set 2, just because it's very helpful to be able to look at this and intuitively see what's happening, you can see in the leftmost column, for each of these larger columns, shows the decimal representation of the ASCII value of each of these characters. So obviously capital A is represented by 65, lowercase a is represented by 97. These are very important things you'll want to remember, just those two values in particular, in case something on the quiz might come up which makes use of these values. Also possibly good to know just generally is that 48 represents the number 0, not necessarily as important as the other, but fairly important. The rest, it's not necessarily important to really know by memory. It's something you can always look up and not so useful to just have locked away in your brain somewhere. So why is this important? Because it allows us to perform arithmetic operations using chars by utilizing the ASCII values which these characters represent. So we see here that if we had a char A and we placed the value A in single quotes, by using single quotes we're saying, okay, we're recognizing this as a character. And when we perform an arithmetic operation on that character, what we're essentially doing is saying, okay, we're looking at the ASCII representation of this number, how this character is actually stored in the bits and bytes in the machine, because keep in mind that a character occupies 8 bits or 1 byte, and since a byte can only really represent combinations of ones and zeros in binary, we're looking at the number essentially which maps to this character, if we remove all abstraction for a moment. Then we can essentially increment this value by 1, get a new ASCII value, and this generates a new character. So you can essentially add a number to the ASCII representation of a character to get a new character. So obviously, in this case, char A equals A plus 1, we would get the next character on the ASCII table, which is obviously B. If we were to look at the second line, int B equals A plus 1, then we're implicitly casting by assigning to an integer the number represented by this arithmetic operation. Since the ASCII value of capital A is 65, we're adding 1 to that, we get 66, and B is set equal to 66. Okay, so talking a little bit about conditionals. So we have our standard comparison operators. We compare two things relative to each other. We have equals equals, two equal signs is the comparison operators, equality operator. We have greater than or equal to, and less than or equal to. These are fairly intuitive. If you have something on one side and on the other side, if the expression as it appears is true, then it's going to return true, else it's going to return false, and you can use that condition to perhaps in a conditional statement to determine whether other code is going to execute. Fairly simple. We also can make use of a Boolean and or a Boolean or. So if this is true and this or this other thing is true, so if this is true, or this other thing is true, then the code executes. Using the ampersand, both of those conditions need be true or else the code which follows will not execute. So this is convenient because, for example, if you were otherwise, if you did not have this OR operator, you would have to have two separate conditional statements. You have an if block, which has one condition, and then the code, and then another if statement with the other condition, and then the exact same code. This allows us to consolidate those two conditions into one statement and save space and avoid replicating code needlessly. Using and, very similar, you'd have to have two nested if statements otherwise to check this is true, and then if this is also true to do something. In this case, we can check them both at the same time and then execute the code if it satisfies the condition that we really are looking for. So, bang. All right. So this is also something that's very useful. It's able to negate an entire condition. So if you have a parenthetical conditional statement and it evaluates to true, then it reverses it and makes it false. If you have a false condition and reverse it, it makes it evaluate to true. So if you wanted to just make sure that something was not greater than something and for some reason you didn't want to use less than or equal to, or assuming there's a more complicated statement that you want to negate, which otherwise would be difficult to write out, and you just want to flip it around, you can use this bang operator. Okay. So using if and else to control flow, if a condition is true, you'll execute the code here. The else statement will catch all other cases. If that condition is false, the else statement will always execute. Else statements, of course, are not always necessary. So just because you have an if statement does not mean you necessarily have to have an else statement. If you have an if without an else, then if the condition is true, it'll execute. But if it's not true, the program just moves on with its life. It does whatever comes next. It doesn't worry about it. There doesn't need to be an else statement. If you only want one statement to execute and you have a variety of conditions you want to check, you can use an if, else if, and then any number of else if statements with varying conditions, and then an else. So what this allows you to do is ensure that only one of these things happens. You can check for various conditions, and when they're satisfied, do something specific. And then if none of them are true, you can use this else as kind of a catch-all, where it's like, if everything else is not true, then do this. It's not necessary to declare another condition here. It just catches whatever comes after all of this if no condition is satisfied.
So in order to have else if, only one of them must be true, right? In between the if and the rest of the else if.
Can you repeat that, please?
In between the one if and the rest of the else ifs that you have, only one can be true.
Not necessarily. It's possible that.
Can you
ask the question, please? Yeah. What this guy just asked is if we have multiple conditions here in an if else if kind of a organization for our control flow, he said, is it true that only one of them can possibly be true? What's actually going to happen is that the first condition is true, is the one that is executed and all else doesn't matter. So if both condition and second condition are true, then only the first code block is going to execute because it's just not going to check what's at the else if. By virtue of being an else if, it becomes completely irrelevant if a previous conditional statement were to be true. So if you made this x is greater than 0, and then the next one was x is greater than 5, so for any positive integer, you do the first thing, and then for the next one, it was, well, any positive integer greater than 5, well, the second one would never be satisfied because the first condition encompasses the second. Okay, so on the topic of loops, just convenient ways we have in syntax to do something over and over a set number of times or until a certain condition is true. While loop is perhaps the simplest. While a condition is true, do something every time until it's no longer true. So before it's executed, it checks if the condition is true, executes the code. If it's not true, it goes back to the top and does everything again until the... Or if it is true, it goes back to the top and does it again until the condition is no longer satisfied. A do-while loop is slightly different. Whatever is kept in the code block will be done at least once. The conditional is not checked until after it's executed at least once. So it'll do something, check if the condition is satisfied. If it is still satisfied, return to the top and do it again and again. So a useful example and something that's perhaps helpful in writing some code where you're getting input from users is considering, okay, so I'm getting an input from the user and I want to make sure that it's a digit between 1 and 10. So you'd say, get input from user, and then check. Your condition could be, is the input between 1 and 10 like I want it to be? If it's not, you go right back to the beginning and you keep asking for input until you get what you want. For loops are a very versatile kind of loop, and its syntax you really want to make sure you get down. It's a little confusing at first for a lot of people, but it's something that just allows you to... It's a very powerful tool, which expresses a lot very succinctly. So when you're starting a for loop, in your parenthetical statement, you have three expressions you want to provide. The first is your initialization arguments. Now, you can perhaps set up a counter variable, like an int I, an int j, an int k, int x, whatever you want it to be, and give it a starting value. I find that a lot of students tend to declare their counter variables before the for loop and then make use, set them to zero perhaps or some other value within the parenthetical statement. You can actually do that even more succinctly. You can just declare your counter variable in the initialization argument. So having never declared int I, j, k before in your code, you can write for parentheses int I equals zero and any other initialization arguments you want to provide. And that that variable would be local to the loop. And it's not necessary to take up lines above and confuse your code by declaring those variables up above. So this is done once at the start of the loop, and then it's not touched again. Then after a semicolon, you have your conditional checked, which is checked before each iteration. So if your conditional is always false, your loop is never going to loop. And after your code is executed, before it executes again, then it checks the conditional. If it's satisfied, it loops again. Otherwise, it quits out of the loop. Then after your last semicolon, the second one, you have a variable update. And this is performed after each iteration. So often you'll use something like i++, i-, and what this essentially means, obviously, is that you're incrementing by one or decrementing by one. And in case there is any confusion about that, it always happens after your code has executed each time. The variable update comes last. So just to see the syntax in its written out form, you have for int x equals 0, x less than, say, 10, x plus plus. Then it does something. This code will loop exactly 10 times and do something exactly 10 times. Okay, so on the topic of variables, a variable is just a way of declaring information of a certain type and storing it in the computer somewhere so that you can reuse it again later. It has to be declared before it's used. If you try to reference a variable before you've declared it at some point in your file, GCC is going to complain to you, and you're not going to be able to compile and get your program to run. It's declared by writing the type of the variable followed by the name you want to give it, hopefully something useful like an actual word that describes what it does, something like int num, char alpha, float change might have been something you saw on PSET 1 when we were doing the greedier optimal algorithms for change, etc. Okay, so in this case, we have a very short snippet of code from some program. We're declaring an int x, and then we're printing %d backslash n, and then placing x in the value for %d. So what's going to happen here? What does x contain in it? Yeah, it could absolutely be any value which could be stored in an integer, because when the variable x is initialized, it finds somewhere in memory that's not being used right now and says, okay, this is x. These 4 bytes, since that is an integer, we're going to call it x. We can do what we want with it, interpret it as an integer. When I try to print that out, it looks at whatever's there already. The computer isn't just going to wipe all those ones and zeros out for me conveniently and make it zero. It's going to give me whatever's there. So we don't really know. It could contain absolutely anything. So if I initialize like x equals 40, int x equals 42, then I can be absolutely sure that x is going to contain 42 when I print it out, unless I've done something else to it, of course. All right, so variable scope. Local variables are those which are declared within a function. Local variables get the name, obviously, because a function is only able to access, a function is able to access them. They may not be accessed outside of the function. If you want to use a value which is stored in a local variable, you need to return it or otherwise assign it to a global variable or doing something creative with pointers. Normally, when you exit out of a function, you have local variables. Since those are just kept on a distinct stack frame, which is owned by that particular function, they will be wiped out, and you can't depend on them being in there in the future. Global variables are declared outside any functions, so it would be somewhere above above your main function. And these are unique in that they can be accessed by any function. So if you had an int x declared outside of main, then that means any function that you called can make use of that variable x, change its value, access the value that's presently there, do anything with it that it wants. This is something you generally want to avoid, even though it sounds very convenient, because it's hard to keep track of what you're doing with your global variables, and you can't always count on their values being something specific, which is a weakness when you're not thinking through your designs absolutely explicitly. Okay.
Mike up next.
Hi, so we're going to talk a bit about functions. It's going to be very introductory. For those, it's going to be going to go into details of recursion. But now, let's see, what is a function made of? It takes a couple of parameters, right? Here we have two ints. It has a type, the return type, which has to match whatever you're returning here. And it has a function body where you just do stuff. Now, for main, the contents of the function are just like a black box. All main cares about is the inputs. They can be one or more, like we had there, one or more parameters, and the output, the return statement. Now, the function could return nothing. If it's the function of type void, it could return an int, a float, a double, a char, and so on. The function name, the only case in which you could get an error there would be if you had the function name as two separate words. That's not legal. The parameter list can be empty, like here. This is equivalent to saying void in between the parentheses. You could have one integer, one char, various variables, one or more parameters. And we're going to talk about pass by value and pass by reference in a second. The function body will have local variables, side effects, statements, loops, and so on. And if the function is of type not void, it has to return something, so you must have a return statement. So probably this is the simplest function. It doesn't return anything because of type void. It takes no parameters, and all it does is it prints something to the screen, which is called a side effect. This function, however, does return. And you've probably seen this function in your section in the third week when you did the recursion. Here, where I've just implemented iteratively instead of recursively, I'm just computing the factorial as a product inside a loop. The return type of the function is the same one as we declared the function upstairs. Okay. Now, just to check, this function has a bug. Can someone point it out to me? It's a small one, but yes, louder, please. Return. What's wrong with return?
Sum divided by 2.
Can you repeat what he
said? He said return sum divided by 2, but that's not.
A float?
Yes, you return a float, and the type of the function is an integer, so that's a type mismatch, and that would be. Thank you, Jesse. Thank you. Okay. Okay. Okay, so we all got recalled. Okay, so why did I represent the function as a black box? Because, the compiler needs to know only what you give to the function, its inputs, and what you take from the function, its return. So if I do a type mismatch, then you will have compile problems. Now here, there's a bit more complicated program. We have a function prototype. That's what tells the compiler how much memory to allocate for the parameters and for type of function. We have two local variables in main. They call a function average over here. And this is the function declaration, which is a different thing than the prototype, which is up there. Now, in terms of scope, global variables can be accessed by any function. You have to declare them outside of main. local variables, even those inside of main are local variables, are variables defined inside a function. They disappear once the function returns. And in this case, globals are AB. Locals are this. Locals are the XY here, and defines parameters as the function. Sum also is a local. And now again, a small bug with a function is supposed to increment an integer. Want someone to tell me what the what we printed by print file here? Okay, one and one. One, two. Yes. So, what do you think? What do you think x is one over here? Okay, it's called pass by value. So what we've done here is we're making a copy of the variable we pass to this function. The copy is called x. This copy is a local variable to the function increment. It's a different variable than the local x to main. The variable x inside of increment gets incremented here, returns 2, which accounts for y equals 2. But x itself inside of main is not changed. So that's what we call pass by value. If you actually want to change the value of x, you would call the function with int pointer to x, and then you would declare the function as taking a parameter pointer to an integer, and you would call it with the address of x. And that's called pass by reference, and I think Jesse will talk more about this. Now, in this scope also applies to nested loops, and in this nested loop, there is a problem. If anyone can point out. Again, a problem of scope. Sum gets defined, disappears, and then we use again. Yes?
I only exists within the for loop.
So. Yes, so I only exists within the for loop. So once I print file here I is no longer defined. We stopped using I here. It only existed, since I declared it for int I, it only exists within the first for loop. So that's another. Arrays, just like your mailboxes in your dorm rooms, they're contiguous blocks of memory. They're all made out of equally sized boxes. And they're accessed with indices from 0 to n minus 1. If you, for strings in particular, we need to end, if you have an array of char stars, you need to end it with a special terminator backslash 0, which tells the program that you're at the end of the string. So this would be at position n minus 1 of every string. And now here, again, there's a very silly thing, namely. Yes, because so it's seg faults because we're changing memory that's not ours. We've only allocated student grade from 0 to n minus 1, and now we're trying to change a position that's outside the bounds of our array somewhere here. Okay. So you've seen in your PSET 3 how you've used sort. And you've passed an array to the function sort, where you did, insertion sort or bubble sort or whatever. Now, the array itself is passed by reference here. You can actually change the contents of the array, and that's what we called in the piece that we mentioned, destructively sort the array. You actually change the values within the array. So for arrays, when you pass an array to a function, you pass it by reference. However, if you would pass to sort, if I would call sort with array of 5, what do you think would happen? they would just give the function the value that's located at the fifth position within the array. So that would be, I would pass the that value to the function instead of the array. An array, you can think of an array as a pointer, and I think Jesse will talk more about this. Now, arrays and functions. I've used here a recursive function to count the number of repetitions of the char ch in the input string. And as you see, we want to make sure that your string isn't empty. That's why we have the first if. And if it's not empty, then I keep counting. I add one to the result, and I keep counting on the remainder of the string. So why do we use functions at all? Well, first of all, you need to have some logical flow and organization of your program. It will help you find your own bugs and will help your reader. You also break down the problem into smaller problems. But also in terms of reusability, we can create our own libraries. Hopefully you will do so after you have the course in your own projects, such as cs50.h. Oops, did we remove the two slides?
No
mention? Okay, just two things about that. Be careful that the type string is not defined in C, it's only defined in our library. And also the boolean, the type bool, is also only defined in our library, as well as some functions like getIn, getFloat. And so if you ever call those functions in your programs, make sure you include cs50.h. And yeah, that's about it. Thanks.
Hi, everyone. I'm Rose. And right now I'm going to talk about recursion, searches, sorting, and time complexity. So a recursive function is when a program calls itself, as opposed to just running through the program and not calling itself. And it performs a task by repeating smaller, similar tasks. So that can sound a bit confusing. So an example would be, I'm sure you've all seen factorial. When you do a factorial, you basically take, like say you had four factorial, you would take, four factorial is actually 4 times 3 factorial, and that's actually 4 times 3 times 2 factorial. So you can see how there's many repeating smaller, similar tasks in the factorial. And one thing you need to know for your recursion functions is that you always need a base case to stop. Otherwise, you're just going to keep on calling itself over and over, and then your program is probably going to crash or do something really bad. So instead of showing you the factorial recursive function, I decided to put up something more interesting. This prints the characters of a string recursively, because I'm sure you know the iterative version where you have a for loop and you just go across the elements of the array. So there's a recursive part right here where it calls itself print chars, and it sends in the array with like incrementing the spot. So I'm going to show you how this works. So somewhere in main, there's that line. Like there's other stuff too, but there's that line that invokes print chars. And say that's your array, ftw with a backslash o because it's a string. So I think Jesse is going to talk more about the call stack, but for now I'm just going to have a simplified version where the, because whenever a function gets called, it gets its own stack frame and it gets put onto the call stack. So I'm going to have a simplified version here to show you what's going on, because I think it's integral to understanding recursion. So say somewhere in main that line gets called or it gets executed. So you get, you know, spot equals 0 of the print chars function. And you also get its stack frame right here. And then once it, OK, so since the spot is 0, you're looking at the spot that has f in it, you're looking at. So going through the function, it looks at the base case. Is this true? No, not right now. So it looks at the else. And then it prints your, you know, prints that spot. So you get f. Yay. And then, OK. Well, I think it's exciting. And then it goes down to this line where it calls an instance of itself with spot plus 1. So since it called itself, you get another stack frame, except with now spot is 1. So now you're like looking at the t spot. And then it goes through again, base case, no. So it's going to do else, and it's going to print, yay, the next letter. And then it goes and it calls itself again. And then, you know, it happens over and over until, well, I guess, okay, you print that. And then it calls itself again. And then you're at the null character. And then, yes, the base case, it happens. You're not going to go on and print, like, random crazy stuff. So this is good. Base case stops you from your stack, like, getting too large, I guess. Okay, so then it returns, which pretty much knocks off the stack frame. And then, well, it knocks off the stack frame, so that's gone. So now notice that your spot is, like, it's going backwards, because when you called it, all those other times you called, the function called itself, it was still there on the call stack, so they never returned. Like, they were still there waiting for the one they called to be done, so they can finish. So now that it's down there, they can all return and be happy. Yay! So, then print chars, yeah?
See? How do we know that spot starts at zero?
Oh, because I set it so that main sends in. Oh, the question was, how do we know spot starts at zero? Well, if you look up there, I sort of said somewhere in main, you send in the array and you send in the number zero. So I sort of set that. And then, so here's a really cool fact that I thought was awesome. If you switch these two lines right here, which I think they're already switched on the slide, you'll actually print the, like, the characters backwards. You'll print the string backwards just by switching those two lines. And that's because it'll call itself before it prints, and then when it returns, then it'll print. So I'm going to show you how that works. Hey, what's up? Okay, so pretend that we're on the returning spot, because it would be easier if we just started here instead of, like, building up our call stack. So yay, we're going to return when spot equals 3. So that's done. That's gone. So we go back to the function that called the one that just returned. And here we're still at that point in the code, because this can't execute until what it called was returned. So then the code continues, because the one that it called returned. So now we get to print W, because spot was 2, when spot was 2 in this case. So we get to print that, and then it returns. And then you can sort of see what happens. Like when it returns, it goes down. So yeah. See, so do you guys see that? When okay, so when a function calls itself, it's sort of like, let's say when it calls itself, it's the callee sort of freezes at that point in the code until what it called, like, is finished. Then it can go on doing the rest of its code. So as you can see, just switching those two lines, the order of when you invoke recursion versus when you print actually matters, so you should watch out for that. So now I'm going to talk about searching. And linear search, I'm sure you all know, is when you walk through your array looking at each spot at a time. So in this demo, we're going to be looking for the number 50, because I like 50. So linear search, you walk down your array, and you're like, oh, I see 50, yay, I found it. Versus binary, where you sort of split it in half, and then you check the middle value, and then you only look on the half that pertains to the value that you're looking for. So cautionary, this has to be a sorted array, otherwise you would be looking randomly, and that would be bad. So say here we split in half, we're looking at the number 24, we're like, okay, 50 is greater than 24, so we can just get rid of the other half that's smaller. And then we're like, okay, let's split our half in half. And then, what do you know, we found 50, yay! So as you can see, binary is much faster than linear, but you need a sorted array for it to work, otherwise, yeah. Okay, so I'm going to talk about sorting. And some sorting algorithms, like I think the four main ones that we learned. So insertion is, there are the steps. You have an array. You look for the smallest number in the unsorted part, and then you put it in front and sort of push the rest down. And then you repeat it until it's all sorted. So here's a demo. First you look at 42 and you're like, oh, I don't have a value, so that must be, that looks like it could be the smallest. Then you see 3 and you're like, oh, that's smaller than 42. And then, nope, not smaller, not smaller. Yay, I'm gonna stick 3 in front. And then you repeat. And then you're like, oh, 17 is the smallest. Yay, I'm gonna stick that next to the 3. And then, oops, that exclamation point shouldn't be there. It should be on the 42 still. And then look at 50, and then you're like, yay, I'm done. So you just take the smallest from the unsorted, and you stick it in front or at the rightmost end of the, your sorted list, and then you push the rest down. And then for selection sort, it's almost, it's similar, but not quite the same. You still look for the smallest number in the unsorted part, but then you switch it with the first slot of the unsorted. So you don't do the pushing stuff down, you switch it. So here's a PowerPoint demo of that. You go through the array looking for the smallest number, and again, it's 3. So see how 3 switched with 42? Well, I guess it was the same in the other one because 42 is the first one. But then you go down and you look for the next smallest number, which is 17. And then you switch that with 42. 17 and 40, wait, no. Yeah, 17 and 42 switched. And then you repeat until everything is all sorted. Yay. Okay, so bubble sort. What you do here is you have your array, you go down your list or your array, and then if two numbers that are adjacent are out of order, you swap them. And then when you're at the end of the list, go to the front and do it again until, well, if you're smart, until no swaps are made. Or you can just like do it n times, and then that would not be very time efficient. So here's a PowerPoint demo of that. So you had an array, you look at the first two numbers, 42 and 3, they look out of order, you swap them. Then you look at the next two, they're good, so you don't do anything. Then you look at 50 and 17, and you swap those. Okay, so since swaps were made, you have to do it again. So 3 and 42, yay, that's good. 42 and 17, not so much. And then 42 and 50, yay, great. And then since swaps were made, you technically would have to go through it one more time to make sure that no swaps were made. And then, okay, merge sort. So merge sort is a recursive way of sorting. And it's apparently faster than the other ways, but it might be a bit harder to understand. So there's the pseudocode for how you would implement it. And I'm going to show you the demo because I think it's really helpful in understanding how the pseudocode actually like works with it. So you're going to see like arrows all over the place. So first you have this array, and you look at the base case, and you're like, if n is less than 2, return. It is not less than 2, so we're going to go down and do else. Sort left half. So there's the left half, and then you're going to sort it, as in you're going to take it and you're going to stick it back in your sort pseudocode here. So you take it, and you're like, okay, is n less than 2? No, it is not. So we're going to sort, stick the left half back into sort, and then you repeat until you just have 42, in which case n is less than 2, you return. So now you just have this 42 sitting there. And then, if you remember in the printing characters function, when you return, it goes back to the previous instance, and it starts from where it left off there. So before we were at like sort left half, so now we move down to sort right half. So that's the 3. And then I'm not going to like have the arrow move back to if n is less than 2, return, because I'm sure you guys get the idea. So n was less than 2, it returned, you got your... you got your 3, that's been sorted. And next you would merge the sorted halves. So 3 is smaller than 42. And then since that's done, you go back to the, I guess I should have drawn a stack frame, like call stack for this, but you go back to sort right half of that one where you called previously called sort left half on. So now you have 50. And then, wow, n is less than 2, you return. And then you merge those. And then you look at the right half of the very first time you like cut in half. And then you pretty much do the same thing. You sort the left half of this new array that you got, new array. And then since 61 is by itself, you merge it. Okay, so I didn't have no space, so I like copied what was on the previous slide so that you guys can like see better. But the pattern continues. Then you look at the right half, and then that was by itself. So then you merge those, and then, wow, you have your sorted array. Yay. Alrighty, so time complexity. Three of them were mentioned, big O of n, which is the worst case, and then you have theta of n, which is the expected or the average case, and you have omega of n, which is the best case. For this class, I think you're mostly going to be concerned with big O of n, the worst case. So you should probably know some of these big O runtimes. It would be a good idea to include it on your cheat sheet or memorize them or know how you get them. And then there are lots of different types of runtimes. So down here, you'll see these are the types of runtimes we're concerned with. And it goes from best to worst. So constant is better than logarithmic, which is better than linear, better than quadratic, polynomial, and so on. And so ideally, you would want to be like somewhere over here with your algorithm, not down here. And then to help you figure out sort of where these complexities come from, so say you, if you had two things and you knew the big O of, and you tried to combine them, like this is how you would figure out what their like combined big O is. If you were just adding, or if you just had one after the other, you would just take the bigger of the two, and I'll show you why in a minute. And then if you were multiplying, i.e. if they were like nested in each other, they weren't like two separate things just put like stacked on top of each other or the like, you would multiply them. So for an example, say you had a piece of code called f that's big O of n because it's like the inside is constant time stuff, but you're doing like doing it n times. So it's big O of n. And then over here you have g, which you have a for loop nested inside of a for loop. So that's a case where you would use the multiplication math equation, I guess. So if each of those for loops goes through like n times, you would have n squared because it's like nested inside of each other. You'd be using the second equation up there. And then say you wanted to, like, if you wanted to put like f here and then g right under it, not like inside of each other, you would have big O of n squared plus big O of n, except we're only concerned with the highest order, so big O of n pretty much like goes away. Like there should be a cross out of that, but I guess I forgot to include that. But yeah, so it's just that. And then if you wanted to say stick f inside of g, like maybe inside this part, then you would have big O of n cubed because you're like nesting them, so it's you're like multiplying the two. So you would be using the second equation there. And yeah.
I think she deserves a round of applause.
All right, thanks very much. So, last part of the review. So, struts. Hopefully you've all handed in Sudoku at this point. And if you haven't yet handed it in, hopefully you've started, in which case you've seen this. And this is essentially, a struct is a collection of variables that we group them together. So you can think of a struct as a basket that holds lots of different things. And so we use this struct to essentially represent the board for the game. And so the board for the game has a lot of different things associated with it. It has all of the numbers on the board. It has where the position of the cursor is. It has some information about the level and the difficulty and all that other stuff. So we just group this together in a struct. We call this struct G, and then we can access members of this struct by using the dot operator. So we can do g dot y to get the y position of the cursor, or g dot x to get the x position of the cursor. And that's really all that there is to structs. Structs are tools for organization. They help you keep your stuff more organized. If you wanted to, you could write any program without ever using a struct. Is this a good idea? Probably not, because structs make life easier for you and easier for people reading your code. Okay. Questions about structs before we move on to pointers? We'll have time for questions, so feel free to interrupt me at any time.
What does typedef do?
Ah, so typedef is different from structs. Typedef is an operator that essentially allows you to define a keyword for something. So we could do typedef. Can you see the board here with the camera?
Yes.
You can. Typedef A to B, and that means from now on, whenever we write B, it's really A. So one thing that we do for you in the CS50 library, we do typedef char star as string. So if you remember, Mike mentioned that string doesn't actually exist. It's just sort of this variable type that we give you to make your life easier, and now you know what pointers are, and hopefully you'll know even better after this. You know that a string is nothing but a char star. And so we essentially use a typedef to hide that. And you can use typedefs when you are declaring structs to make your declarations shorter, but not an important issue. All right, so pointers. So the key thing to other questions. Is that how you'd write it?
Yeah.
Yes, that is how you'd write it. Okay, so pointers are essentially addresses. So you can think of the memory in your computer as a very, very large array. And so the way we index memory from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, well, the actual memory in your computer, or the RAM, is also indexed from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. And so every location in memory has an address. And your computer internally, if you declare a variable int x or some array, my array or whatever, that variable is not referenced by name, it is referenced by address. And so essentially every location in memory has an address. And sometimes it's useful for us to be able to play with these addresses directly. So variable names are a convenience that the compiler gives us. Addresses are what it's really like under the hood. And sometimes it's nice to be able to reach your hand under the hood and play around with the addresses. So there are two primary operators associated with pointers. We've got star and we've got ampersand. And they are inverses of each other. So star, some variable, these are unary operators, so they take one argument. Star, some variable means, treat this variable as an address, go to that location in memory, and give me the value. So if I were to do star 400, this is going to say 400 is some address. Go to the location in memory that has the address 400 and read me whatever is there. So this isn't actually valid syntax because this is not typed as a pointer. But if we cast it to a pointer, we could do that. And ampersand is the opposite of star. So if we do ampersand x, it is saying, oh, x is a variable. Well, that variable is stored somewhere in memory. Where is it stored? Give me the offset at which it is stored. Give me the address of this variable. And so those are star and ampersand. So a couple of examples. So arrays, if we declare int myArray 100, what myArray really is a pointer to some location in memory where we have room for 100 integers. So essentially, 100 integers, each integer is 4 bytes, so that's 400 bytes. And so when we say myArray 100, the compiler gets us 400 bytes in memory, and it says, oh, okay, myArray is now a pointer to those 400 bytes. And we can access the array by using our traditional bracket notation, but we can also just treat myArray, myr, like a pointer, and dereference it, and store things in the array like that. So we're declaring myArray up there. I have this comment saying, so pretend we're filling the array with the number 0 to 99, And then here we're going to print out the contents of the array. So we've got our counter, I is less than 100, and so we're going up. And then we're saying, okay, my array is what? It's the start of the array in memory, right? And so when we're adding I to it, we're essentially saying, here's our very long array in memory, and my array points us to here. And then when we add I, whatever I is, it's saying, so let's say I is 3, we're getting this here. And so now my array plus I, when I is 3, points us right here, right? And if we're looking at our traditional numbering for the array, 0, 1, 2, 3, and so we have an address that points right here. So when we dereference it, we get that value in the array. And so this is an example of how you would use the star operator right here. So question for the audience. An integer is 4 bytes, right? So essentially, every time we shift to a new element of the array, we need to move our address over 4 bytes. So why, when I add I over here, am I not multiplying I times 4 or something like that?
Because the address changes with you?
Because the address changes with me. Can you be a little more explicit?
No.
Yeah. Exactly. So the compiler knows that my array is a pointer to an integer. And so it essentially does the arithmetic for us. It knows that if we want to move by some number, we want to move by that number of integers across. So since an integer is 4 bytes, it does the arithmetic for us. Questions about this small snippet of code right here? No? Okay. So it turns out that 2D arrays are interesting. So if we declare a 2D array, and you've seen 2D arrays in the game of 15 and et cetera, a 2D array is just a very, very long contiguous chunk of memory. So as an example, suppose I wanted to declare a 2D array to represent the board for my game of 15, right? So we want 9 spaces. So I could declare int board 3, 3. And what the compiler gets me is one long piece of memory with 9 spaces. And so essentially it's saying, this is the first row of my board. This is the second row of my board. And this is the third row of my board. And what we get back, my array, is essentially a pointer to the beginning of this memory. So we could iterate over this with 2 loops and double bracket notation, like you all did in 15 and you also did in Sudoku, I'm sure. But we could also pretend that this is a pointer. And so what we've got here is my array plus I times width plus j. So if you imagine, what's happening right now is the I is controlling what, if we're indexing the board? The what? The row, yes. I is controlling the row, and J is controlling the column, right? So if we know that, okay, the board is as wide as width, then if we have multiply I by width, that will offset us the proper number of rows that we want to get to. And then we add J at the end to move us column by column. So really, this is just an example to show you that under the hood, everything in C is a pointer. And we can, just as we do with brackets, we can do everything here with pointers. Questions about this? Yeah?
Why are there 2 stars?
Ah, okay. So this is a cast. So for a slightly technical reason, my array is not actually a pointer to an int. It's a pointer to a pointer to an int. So the question is, why are there 2 stars here? So I'll explain the meaning of each star one by one. So this first star right here dereferences the address. So this long construct right here creates an address for us. And then this star says, go to that address and get me the value there. And this int star here is saying, cast my array as a pointer to an int. So it's essentially saying, do this cast, that way when we add I or we add j, it'll move by the correct number of spaces, by 4 instead of by 1 or such. And that has to do with something with type. This is a more complex example. Yes?
Is it possible to confuse the computer with like a star that you meant to be multiplication, and maybe the computer will think that you're assigning a pointer to something?
Well, it is. Is it possible, because this star is the same as the star for multiplication, is it possible to confuse the compiler and the compiler thinks that you are doing multiplication when you actually want to assign an address, or vice versa? And so the answer to that is no. It is possible for you to make that mistake in your code, but the compiler doesn't get confused because there's a very, very strict set of parsing rules. So either you didn't use parentheses in the right places, right, because you've got to group your things in terms of order of operations and such, or your types are wrong. So, I mean, the compiler is smart to the extent that, so first of all, this star is a unary operator, which means that it only takes one argument. And then the multiplication star is a binary operator, which means it takes two arguments. You've got to have something on the left and you've got to have something on the right. And also, you can't really multiply pointers. So if something is of the wrong type, the compiler will probably alert you to that. So short answer is no, but could confusing situations could arise. Other questions about this example or in general, pointers? Okay.
Can you just explain why you cannot multiply pointers?
Well, I mean, you could multiply pointers, but it wouldn't really make sense to multiply pointers. Because, like, a pointer is a location. So what does multiplying a location by another location mean? Right?
You can add pointers.
Well, you can add pointers because you're saying, like, oh, we've got a location, and then we want to move to another location, some offset from the location, right? It's like, imagine if you're walking down a street and then you're standing in front of like a red house and then somebody's like, oh, my house is like 4 houses down. So that's like, there's your pointer and then you add 4 to your pointer. But like, I don't know what multiplying a pointer would mean. Yeah. I mean, that even probably wouldn't even be valid. You could cast to an int and then multiply and then cast back, but then again. Okay. Dereferencing. So, we've got a nice little example here. Brings together hex and all of your operators, and the question is, what does this print? And if you're in my section, don't answer, because you've seen this already. Anybody want to give it a try? We'll edit you out of the video if you're wrong. So you won't be wrong in posterity. She's probably going to edit this out as well. Okay, so first we're declaring x, all right? And we're setting it to this value, the ox before the value is just saying, oh, interpret this number as a hex number. So first of all, what's the number that we're assigning to x? 2 to the what? 2 to the 32 minus 1. So it's essentially the maximum value for an int. It's the binary number where we've got 1, 1, 1, where we've got 32 ones. Right? 32 ones all in a row. And that just shows you that there's like a direct correspondence between each digit in hex and 4 bits in binary. Okay. And then we're declaring A. So what type is A? Exactly. A is a pointer to an int. And when we say A is equal to address of X, we're saying, oh, okay, X is somewhere in memory. Let's get where X is in memory, and let's store that in A. Right? And then when we're declaring B, what type is B? It's a character. Well, it's a pointer to a character. So then we're saying, oh, X is somewhere in memory. Let's store that location in B. So now what we've got is we've got two pointers, both pointing at the location where X is in memory. And now we're doing printf. We're printing F two numbers, and we're dereferencing A, and we're dereferencing B. So we're saying, go to the address of A, and get me what value is there, and print that out as an integer. And we're saying, go to the address of B, and get me what value is there, and print that out as an integer. So what is the first number that this is going to print? It's not going to print garbage, right? It's not going to print the address of X either. So A has the address of X stored. And then when we use the star, we're saying, go to that address and get me what is located at that address. We're going to get 2 to the 32nd minus 1, right? We're going to print this big number, FFFFFFFF. So it's like 4 billion something. Okay. The second one. What is the second one going to print? It's not going to print the same thing. It won't print out the letters because I've told printf to treat this as a percent D. So it's going to format it as an integer. But what's it going to print? It's going to print the first byte. So what's that? 255. Excellent. So this is going to print out two different numbers. So, well, do you want to explain why, or shall I?
Because char star B means that you have a pointer that's pointing to a character, and characters are only one byte long, so when you print it, it thinks it's only supposed to print the first byte.
Exactly. So what she said was that A is a pointer to an int, and B is a pointer to a character. And so, in general, ints take up 4 bytes in memory. Characters only take up 1 byte in memory. So when we dereference A, it's saying, go to that location in memory and get me the next 4 bytes that are right there. And so we get all 4 bytes, and that gives us the full value of our hex number. But when we dereference B, since B is of type char star, it's saying, oh, B is a pointer to a character. So we need to go to that location in memory, which is the same location as X, but we only need to take 1 byte from that location instead of all 4 bytes. So what we're getting is just FF instead of FFFFFFF. And so that's why this is going to print like 4 billion something and then 255. So the key lesson here is pointers are all 4 bytes. Or if you're on a 64-bit architecture, they're 8 bytes. They all point to locations in memory. Depending on their type, that's going to give you different behavior when they're dereferenced. Because when they're dereferenced, you will get different number of bytes out of memory. That'll also give you different behavior when you do something previously, when we're doing adding I or adding J here. If this were a char star pointer instead of an int star pointer, adding I would only be adding I times 1. But here, since it's an int star, we're adding I times 4. And the compiler knows about the types and takes care of this for us. So, questions about pointers before we move on to malloc? Yes?
What does the char star in parentheses do with the address?
Up here. So that is something I had to put in to avoid a compiler error. That's not a pointer, that's an entire screen. So the question is, what is the char star and X over there? And that is a cast. So it's saying, when we do and X, we're getting the address of X. But X is of type int star. So if we try and store an int star in a char star, even though they're the same size, the compiler is smart, realizes, oh, we might be making a mistake, and it'll give us a warning saying, warning, you're storing an int star in a char star, like type mismatch warning or something like that. And so if we cast it explicitly to a char star, we're avoiding that warning. So, you know, I did that for the purpose of perpetrating the trick here. Other questions about pointers? Yes.
So I know previously we've seen like int A was ampersand X, and then you just use the star A like later. How does it differ in
Okay, so if you declared int a equal to ampersand x, that would give you a compiler error, because ampersand x is of type int star, and a is of type int. So if you wanted to store a pointer in an integer, you'd have to cast it first. And you could do that, and you could, you know, you could do that, but it's not a, in general, good. Does that answer your question? Yeah? Okay. Others? We've got some time. No? Okay. So malloc. So malloc is a way to get memory for our program dynamically. And so malloc is a function that takes a single argument, and that argument is an integer, and the argument says, get me a piece of memory of n bytes, where n is the argument that we're giving to malloc. And malloc gives us back a pointer to that memory. So we use malloc when, for example, we're going to need some memory in a program, but we don't know how much memory we need in advance. So suppose, well, CS50's library, getString, is something that uses malloc. And you can go home and look at the implementation of getString if you like, and I'll describe it briefly here. The user types in a string. And now we've got to store that string in memory in an array of chars. But we don't know how long the string that the user is going to type in advance, right? So what we have to do is we have to figure out how long the string is, and then we have to malloc a piece of memory that's big enough to hold that string. We couldn't just say, oh, you know, some array of chars with 40 characters. Because, well, maybe sometimes a user types in a string that's only 2 characters, and then we're wasting 37 characters of the array. Why are we wasting 37 characters of the array and not 38, incidentally? If they type in a 2-character string. Null character at the end, right? So the string always is ended with a null character. Okay, so we'd be wasting 37 characters, which is not good. And what if they type in a string that's like 400 characters? Then we don't have enough to store it. So we've either got to return an error, or we've got to do a buffer. We have a buffer overflow exploit, which you learned about as well, but won't be on the quiz, I believe. So basically, malloc allows us to get a variable amount of memory in the program. And that memory is allocated not on the stack, but on the heap. And so if you, as you saw in Rose's beautiful slides, stack frames are created with each function, and then when the function leaves, that stack frame goes away. Heap is persistent across the execution of the entire program. So if we malloc something, we get a piece of memory on the heap, and it doesn't matter which function we're in, as long as we're in the same program, that piece of memory on the heap will be there, and we can access that piece of memory on the heap if we know its address, if we know where it is. And you can make that memory go away explicitly by calling the function free. So this is the only case when you use free. So, quick example. What can we do for malloc? So, suppose we need some amount of memory we don't know in advance, right? So we're getting an integer from the user, and we want to allocate enough memory to store an array of n integers, where n is some amount that the user types in. We don't know what it is. So we're calling getInt, cs50.h, I should probably pound included up there, and then we're mallocing n times size of int. So why am I multiplying by size of int? Somebody whispered it. Let's.
You can get the correct size.
So I can get the correct size, meaning an int is, well, in general, an int is 4 bytes. So we could write n times 4, but different computers have ints of different sizes. Especially now, many computers are starting to be 64-bit, which means that ints are 8 bytes now. And so when we use size of int, that's saying, oh, for this particular computer, what's the size of an integer? And we'll multiply by the right size. So we're saying, okay, this is, in most cases, n times 4. We're getting that number of bytes, and it's passing back a pointer, which we're storing now in x. So x is a pointer to this piece of memory. So we can treat x exactly like an array. And I should do one thing here. There's a small bug in the slides. Got to do this as well. So malloc passes us back a pointer that's of type void star, which just means a generic pointer. So to store it in an instar, we've got to cast it to an instar to make the so that the compiler doesn't complain or give us a warning. So what am I doing on the next three lines of code after that? So we're asking for some amount of memory. What happens if the user types in the number like 10 trillion or something? No, right? We don't have 10 trillion bytes of memory in the computer to give. So it's possible that if we're asking for some memory and that amount of memory doesn't exist, or maybe there's a lot of other things running on the computer at the same time and memory is really heavily utilized, malloc can fail. It can fail and say, oh, yeah, there's no more memory to give you. So if malloc fails, it returns null. And if we try and dereference the null pointer, we'll get a seg fault, or bad things will happen. And so what you always have to do whenever you use malloc is you've got to check to make sure that malloc didn't fail. And if it did fail, you should exit your program gracefully or handle the error condition gracefully rather than just seg faulting and, you know, losing points on your problem set. Yes?
If malloc fails, does it like store like half of what you want and then fail, or does it just say, I can't store this because there's not enough room for the whole thing?
So malloc doesn't store anything. Malloc just gets you a piece of memory. So once you get that piece of memory, you can't assume anything about what's stored there. If you remember Matt's slides from the beginning, he just declared int x. And then we try and print out x, we don't know what we're going to get. Anything could be there. Same thing with malloc. So if malloc can't find the memory, then it just returns you null and you don't get any memory.
Okay.
That's all. Yes. You could then try again and ask for a smaller piece of memory and maybe that amount of memory exists or whatnot. Okay. So once we've gotten this memory and we've checked to make sure that x isn't null, so we actually now have this memory, now x can be treated just like an array or a pointer, or we can use it for whatever we want. And when we're done using x, when nobody needs to use x anymore in the program, then we'd call free. And we could do that just by typing free x. And that is now saying to malloc, oh, I'm done using this piece of memory. You can take it back and give it to somebody else. And so that's all there is to malloc. And that's all there is to this review session. So, questions for me? No? I will have office hours directly afterwards here and then walking towards the Science Center. So if you'd like, you can ask. Yes?
I'm